Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special podcast interview brought to you by the NATO Association of Canada. I'm Michael DeLeo, and today I'm incredibly honored to be interviewing David Mulroney. He is someone who has had an incredibly distinguished career in Canada's Foreign Affairs Department, most notably serving as the Canadian Ambassador to China from 2009 to 2012. Today, he is a Distinguished Fellow at the Monk School of Global Affairs, and he currently serves as the President and Vice Chancellor of the University of St. Michael's College at the University of Toronto. Mr. Mulroney, thank you very much for sitting down today for this interview.
Good to have you with us this morning.
If you could just start off by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself, how did your family and educational background propel you to embark upon a career in the Foreign Service?
Well, I grew up in Toronto. I was born in Halifax, grew up in Toronto, and attended both St. Michael's College School, which is a high school, and the University of St. Michael's College in the University of Toronto, where I studied English and philosophy. I wrote the Foreign Service exam, got in 1981, in part because I had a relative, a cousin, who was a couple of generations older than me, and she had worked for what was then called external affairs in the 40s and 50s, and she always encouraged me to think about an international life and the world of diplomacy. So I always had that in the back of my mind. My wife was and is keenly interested in international affairs and travel, and so she was also a significant influence. And happily enough, I got in 81 and then had postings in Seoul, in Korea, in Shanghai, where we opened our office in the mid-80s, in Kuala Lumpur, in Malaysia, in Taiwan, in the unofficial Canadian office there, and finally in Beijing. And in between times, I served in various roles, including running first the Asia-Pacific branch of the Foreign Affairs, later serving as Associate Deputy Minister and the Prime Minister's Sherpa to the G8 summit, coordinator on Afghanistan, which was a really interesting time and a time of close work with NATO, and ending up in Beijing.
And you started in 1985 in China?
I did.
So even though you've served in all of these different capacities, would it be fair to say that China has probably had the most important effect on you as a diplomat?
I'd say my career was significantly shaped. The significant event for me professionally was the rise of China. The China I saw in the mid-80s was a China that was still in many ways emerging from the Cultural Revolution. The Shanghai then would be unrecognizable to a young person in Shanghai today. So I've seen in my own career some of the more dramatic parts of China's rise.
And you actually also published a book, Middle Power, Middle Kingdom, What Canadians Need to Know About China in the 21st Century. Congratulations, by the way. It was very well received, and it recently won the J.W. Defoe Book Prize.
I was very touched about that, and I went out to Winnipeg to receive the prize and to meet the Defoe Committee, and as an inspiration, I read everything that I could of Defoe's own writings on Canadian history and international affairs, and it was a very inspiring process for me.
And in the book, you talk about not only the history of China, your personal experiences, economic and social policy, but you also talk about the necessity of having a focused China policy. Would it be fair to say that Canada has been slacking when it comes to our interaction with China?
I think it's fair to say in terms of our approach to international affairs in general. I think we're used to a world in which the most serious issues of prosperity and security are largely worked out through our relationship with the United States. And that leaves us free to choose where to get engaged, almost to dabble where we choose. So, you know, it might be India one year and then China the next year, or we have a flirtation with Japan, or we realize that we have a location in South Africa, but we're will-o'-the-wisps. We're entering a new world where we can't afford to do that anymore. And I think China is the first of the emerging partners and countries that we have to take particularly seriously and approach in a whole new way.
And if we think about the history of Canada-China relations beginning in the 20th century, I suppose Pierre Trudeau is still remembered as the one who opened the door to China.
Very much so. And I the only time I ever met Mr. Trudeau Sr. was in China, and I was struck by how impressed Chinese audiences were, including very senior Chinese leaders, by him and by his contribution. And what he did essentially was not just create a formula through which Canada could recognize China. He championed a formula that allowed a lot of other countries to come in and engage the new China, the China of post 1949, in new ways.
And since that time, China has been an increasingly important market for Canada's exports, including, as you write about in your book, seafood. And one of the chapters in your book is entitled Blue Lobster Tweets, and you talk about the perception of Canada's seafood. So how does the transformation of our seafood industry and our fisheries represent our deepening economic ties with China?
Well, you know, my first experience in government before getting sent overseas, I got sent to a regional office of the Canadian government in St. John's, Newfoundland. And that was a very important experience for me because Newfoundland was emerging, the Newfoundland fishery, the East Coast fishery was emerging from a time when we sold fish as a commodity, packed into a block and sold in, you know, McFish sandwiches or whatever, to thinking about our seafood as you say, a high-quality product that's associated with Canada, the way Norway and Iceland, for example, market seafood, the way seafood is sold in Japan. In fact, it was our connection with the Japanese that enabled us to think along these lines because they would come and examine every fish. They'd want it to be visually pleasing and attractive. So what I saw in China over time was us moving from being a supplier of seafood as a commodity to thinking about Chinese tastes, associating our China marketing with the quality that Canada stands for, and opening up whole new possibilities that were far more financially rewarding for us.
And as we increase our economic cooperation with China, we're just inevitably going to come into closer contact with Chinese culture. So do you feel that as Canadians, we possess an adequate understanding of Chinese culture, or do we still have much to learn?
I would answer that question with a definitive yes and no. Yes, we should absolutely understand China's culture, try to understand China's culture, and we should adapt our methods to the differences, just as we would do this anywhere. If you're trying to sell something, you need to understand the people you're selling it to. At the same time, we also need to be savvy enough to know that part of China's culture is to use the very mystique and difference of China as a bit of a negotiating advantage. So they would say, we're so different that you're going to have to adopt a whole new approach, and essentially you're going to have to adopt our approach. So what they're doing is ensuring that they have home field advantage in every negotiation. One of the most problematic aspects is something called guanxi, which means connectedness. So that we do things on the basis of who you know, favors. If you were doing business, you might also want to get my son a place at a university or a visa. I think Canadians need to sort of stand fast and say, just as we respect your culture, you have to respect our culture. So a contract is a contract. It's professional, not personal. And contracts can't change just because conditions have changed. So it's a delicate dance. Respect, but also knowing who you are and what you stand for.
And just as we're talking about culture, do you remember offhand a humorous cultural faux pas that a Canadian delegation or official committed?
There are all kinds of taboos in terms of, you know, what you can and can't give to people. So things like clocks are not good gifts because they're suggestive of the end of time and the end of your own personal time. The most sensitive topics, endlessly problematic, relate to maps and flags because Taiwan refers to itself as the Republic of China. It's incredible the number of times people would think they were using the flag of the People's Republic of China only to have the other one on the flagpole. And I knew a fellow who was taking a Chinese delegation to a Canadian factory, and as he got closer, he saw that they were flying the Taiwan flag, the Republic of China flag, from the flagpole. He told the bus driver, keep going. And he said, well, this is the address. He said, just keep going. While they were going, he phoned the factory and said, whatever you do, take that flag down. So they're funny after the fact, but the Chinese are always fussing over maps and flags.
Our culture is different. Our societal structures are different. And this leads me into the next question I'd like to ask you. A constant debacle that Canada and many other Western countries face is that they want the benefits of an improved relationship with China, but they also need to address the issue of human rights. Can you explain what problems arise when we seek to do such a thing?
Yeah, and I think you're right in describing it as a debacle. It's very difficult to get it right. It starts, though, with an understanding on the Canadian end of what are we trying to do? Because China is big and assertive, it draws the ire of human rights champions everywhere, as it should. But sometimes we need to think beyond making a statement, saying something that makes us feel good for about 15 seconds, and then what happens is the conversation is over and China's not talking to you anymore and you have zero influence. So how do you combine that very natural sense of wanting to influence and affect change with real strategies to do that? And at the same time, how do you keep up a conversation with a country that's so important? It's not in our interest to stop talking to China. And if we adopt only a sort of censorious tone in our conversation, the conversation will end. So what I've suggested is, one, we have to focus on, you know, what are our core objectives when it comes to human rights and China? Where can we make a difference? What matters most to us? Second, we need to talk with our allies about a division of labor. So sometimes if a dissident was imprisoned or there was an issue, we would agree that we'd go in with the Americans or with the EU and others. And sometimes if there's a visit by another leader, we'll ask, could you mention our person in prison too? Similarly, if the Swedes asked us or the Brits, we'd help them out. So you need to work together with the like-minded. Then you also need to think about programming. It's not just talking to or at the Chinese, it's working with them. One of the most impressive programs I remember was one funded by the Canadian International Development Agency, where we worked with Chinese partners to help migrant workers, mainly women, understand their rights in the Chinese system. It wasn't just Canada who wanted to do this. The local government thought it important. There was an NGO for women in China that thought it important. And even the railway said they'd help us because they said, we see a lot of these migrant workers, we think they might be at risk. Could we give out some of the pamphlets on the program? So it was a great example of connecting with Chinese reformers, bringing resources from Canada, and really making a difference. So you need to think about human rights holistically. You need to raise them at the highest levels. You need to speak out on key cases, but you also need to work quietly and respectfully with like-minded partners in China to make a difference.
One of the most important human rights is religious freedom. And this is something that you talk about at great length in the book, the general religious landscape in China. You also make it more interesting by talking about your own experiences as a Catholic in what is an officially atheistic state. Can you talk a little more about that experience?
Yes. So it was in many ways important for me to experience, because I've lived, you know, live in a wonderful country. I've always been privileged. I've never had any hardships in my life. So I haven't had the experience that so many people do of feeling marginalized. And it was instructive for me to be a Catholic in a country where people of all religions are held under they're under the thumb of the government. It helped me to understand in a very small way what people who face much more serious oppression actually experience. So this was instructive, but again, it was only for me a passing awareness, but an important awareness nonetheless. Second, one of the things that the propositions that St. Michael's makes to the University of Toronto and to the world is that we are a Catholic university with emphasis on both words. You can be Catholic and you can be a member, a productive member of secular society. I was a very proud public servant and proud of the values and ethics of the Canadian Public Service, which, while being a secular institution, was extremely welcoming to people of all backgrounds, believers and non-believers. I never felt uncomfortable for a single day as a Catholic. Now, when you're ambassador or a senior official, you're not there, as I said. I wasn't in China as the ambassador of the Republic of David Mulroney. I was there as the ambassador of the Dominion of Canada. That said, I did take a keen interest in religion as a human rights issue. And wherever I traveled, I tried to visit Buddhist groups. When I was in Tibet, certainly, and elsewhere in China, I loved to see mosques and visit Islamic groups, in part because of a personal interest in architecture and how Islam and Chinese culture come together in very interesting ways. And I blogged and tweeted about these things with Chinese followers. I was also interested in Christianity, so Protestant house churches, China's ongoing struggles with the Catholic Church. And I incorporated what I found into suggestions to Ottawa for programming when we had an ambassador for religious freedom, and into my own briefings and commentary, because religion is an issue in China. It's an issue that mystifies and worries the Communist Party, which is avowedly atheist, because some of its own members are caught up in this search for something deeper in life. As much as China has been able to satisfy many material needs, I think there's a longing for something different, and we see many manifestations of this. So this was a subject worthy of my attention and study on its own.
Was there ever a personal issue that made it a bit more complicated?
Where it got more complicated for me was when we were asked as an embassy to provide space for the international Catholic community for Mass. They had no space for mass. This was at a time when China was cracking down on the church and it was more difficult to go to the official state-run churches. What happened was I said we could only do it if we found volunteers within the embassy who could make it happen and if we offered other faith groups the same opportunity, and we did both of those things. But it was also a very satisfying time in my own life because I became a member of that parish to see people from all over the world, from Africa, from all over Asia, from Europe, Latin America, all these international people who had otherwise no place to worship in sort of confidence and security. We'd have more than 200 people come to the embassy. And I thought it said it was a useful gesture, but it spoke to the international community about Canada's tolerance of religious freedom. And it was also a reminder that some of the first Canadians to make an impact in China were missionaries.
So were you disappointed with the decision made by the Trudeau government to close the Office of Religious Freedom?
I feel that it should not have been closed. I was disappointed that it was closed. I think it's partly a political issue. It was frankly a difficult office for people in foreign affairs to get their minds around because people are so attuned to serving a secular culture and living in a secular culture that can lead them to almost disqualify gestures or activities related to religion that are in themselves valid. They're so afraid that this might seem favoritism rather than a natural extension of what we should do and something that we might want to build into our human rights policy that the department struggled to understand it. I don't think the Conservatives brought to it more than a semi-political agenda. So I think there was a great missed opportunity. Other countries, notably the U.S., do it much better.
So generally speaking, human rights are a difficult issue to tackle. And this can put a strain on our relationship when we try to talk about these things. But things do start to look up a bit when China uses one of its most well-known and lovable, I should say, forms of soft power as a negotiating tool, pandas.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about the significance of pandas?
Well, China practices what people refer to as panda diplomacy, because as you say, it's hard for China to win friends and influence people, given that the Chinese regime itself is an unfriendly regime in many ways. It does things that quite deservedly bring censure on the Communist Party of China. And when you do polling in the Asia-Pacific region, lots of people feel cool to China as a result. The other thing is, I don't think China understands soft power. The United States has soft power not because the American government invented Bruce Springsteen or movies. It's because American culture is very dynamic and ultimately attractive to people around the world. If China were to follow some of the same practices and, for example, allow Ai Weiwei greater freedom, they might find that people were interested in China too. But because the party tries to control the message and really doesn't understand what people in free societies are interested in, they generally fail. But they are blessed with pandas, right? And they didn't invent them. God invented them. And people the world over love pandas. So they lucked into that one. And what China does is, because the giant panda comes only from China, is that when they feel that your relationship is on a good footing, when they want to reward you or bring you closer, they offer the loan of pandas, never the gift, the loan of pandas to a zoo in your country. And Canada had received pandas in the 1980s. Toronto had pandas, but we hadn't had any since. And we were going through a long, chilly period in the Harper era. By the time that began to warm up, pandas were again on offer. What happened next was really confusing to Canadians. The president of China, on a visit to Canada in 2010, said, "We are prepared to negotiate the loan of two pandas to Canada." Canadians didn't understand what that meant. What it meant was, it's okay by us, so your zoo or zoos have to communicate with the appropriate people in China. There are some technical details to work out. If they work them out, the pandas are going to be on their way to Canada. Canadian politicians thought that somehow China hadn't agreed because there were these conditions attached. So they kept asking Chinese politicians. And we had to say, you don't have to ask anymore. They've said yes. It was confusing the Chinese. But what we have to do is take the technical stuff seriously and put together a proposal that will convince the technical people in China. So this took a lot of back and forth. This is where the embassy played a really key role. We had a guy named Mark McDowell, who's just finished up being our ambassador in Burma. And Mark would sit in on these meetings between the Canadian zoos in Calgary and Toronto and the Chinese authorities. And he'd help the Canadians understand after the meeting, when they say this, they mean this. And sometimes it's they mean exactly what they said. Sometimes it's they mean what they said plus a little more or maybe a little less. He'd similarly go to the Chinese and say, this is why the Canadians said they can't do this. You know, they really mean it. So he was a very effective intermediary, and he helped to get the deal done, which has brought pandas to Toronto, and we'll ultimately see them in Calgary.
So going forward, we have the pandas, and we also have another prime minister who can set a new tone for Canada-China relations. What would be your advice to Mr. Trudeau on the best way to approach China?
My advice would be that this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. They've already, I think, done the right thing in terms of reinstituting annual visits. So first thing is you've got to talk to the Chinese and you have to have a regular mechanism for talking to them. But in doing that, you also have to know what you want. So we need to spend a lot more time thinking about what we want from China and what we don't want from China in a changing world. And that means attaching a priority, as we discussed at the beginning, to the relationship, thinking really carefully about our interests and objectives and values, and then coming up with a strategy that enables us to advance those. And that means bringing discipline and coherence to government. And I saw this was in my other life on Afghanistan, through what was called the Manley Panel, where John Manley and some wise people gave advice to the government. We finally began to focus on the mission in Afghanistan in ways that brought the entire government together to think about not 100 objectives, but 3 or 4. I think we similarly need to think about in the relationship with China, not 100 things that we need to do, but the maybe 3 to 5 that are absolutely critical for our security and prosperity and our values going forward.
This has been a special presentation brought to you by the NATO Association of Canada. Thank you for listening.